supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Bill Cosby is heading into round two of his criminal trial next month. I'm Dave Heller, and this is Newsworks Tonight. Cosby is accused of sexually assaulting Andrea Constant in his Cheltenham home in 2004. The first trial ended with a hung jury last summer. Today, attorneys for both sides sparred over who would be allowed to testify this time, and Cosby's defense attorneys repeatedly asked for the case to be thrown out. Let's learn more with WHYY's Laura Benshoff, who joins us from outside the Montgomery County Courthouse in Norristown. Laura, was anything significant decided by the judge today?
Well, Judge Stephen O'Neill has a handful of motions in front of him, and he did dismiss two of them. These were two motions filed by the defense to try to get the case tossed out. And when court adjourned a little while ago, the judge was in the process of determining whether any of the 19 women who prosecutors want to testify that they say Cosby drugged and sexually assaulted them, whether any of them will be allowed to testify in the trial next month. And these are women whose claims never were rose to the level of going to trial. But prosecutors made this sort of gambling or probability analogy, basically saying the more examples of the same type of behavior that you see, you know, the less likelihood that the next time it happens that it will be just an accident or a mistake. So that was one of their rationales for wanting so many of these other, as they say, prior accusers to testify. And all of these women say they never consented to sexual contact that they had with Bill Cosby. And defense attorneys are going to go on tomorrow morning to give their take on whether or not these women should be able to testify. But in court filings, we see that they're arguing that this is all about fairness, that these cases are old, they're too vague to sort of properly refute, and they'll unfairly bias a jury against the comedian. And so we're going to hear more on that tomorrow, and the judge says he'll take his time deciding that one.
The case is being presented before the same judge. Let's see, same prosecutor, same defendant, same complainant. What's different?
So, you know, it does feel a little bit like Groundhog Day as a reporter, but there are some changes. Cosby has a completely retooled defense team. So the new lead defense attorney, his name is Tom Mesereau. He defended Michael Jackson against some child molestation claims. There will be a different jury. This time it'll be drawn not from Allegheny County, but from Montgomery County. And, you know, the world outside has changed. The Me Too movement has really cracked open a lot more stories like those that have of the women who have accused Bill Cosby. And so even though it's not really filtering into the courtroom, that's happening outside. As well, Cosby recently lost his daughter, Ensa, which the judge did acknowledge at the outset of court today.
Laura, lastly, describe the tone in the courtroom today.
It felt a little more combative than the last time around. I mean, right off the bat, the district attorney, Kevin Steele, asked the judge to just dismiss Cosby's out-of-state attorneys. And in his words, it's because they were telling flat-out lies in court filings. And that relates to a claim that Cosby's team has since walked back. They've made a filing of prosecutorial misconduct, basically saying that they think the prosecutors concealed some interviews from them. That turned out not to be the case. And defense attorneys tried to get the case dismissed, saying that the prosecutor's office has totally bungled this. So there's a lot of questioning each other's credibility and a lot of sort of right off the bat, aggressive statements made in court today that were a little bit different from the last time around.
Taking this all in, was the defendant, were you able to assess Bill Cosby's mood?
You know, he's very stony-faced. He's hard to read. He's often bent over the table where the defense attorneys sit. So I can't say that I have a real bead on what's going through the 80-year-old comedian's mind right now.
Thanks, Laura.
Thanks, Dave.
WHYY's Laura Benshoff outside the courthouse in Norristown. After reviewing several proposals from the state's GOP and Democratic leaders, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court released its own congressional district map for the upcoming midterm election. The change came after the court ruled the prior map violated the state constitution as a partisan gerrymander. But Keystone Crossroads' Lindsay Lazarski reports, even with a new plan in place, there's still some confusion as to what makes a legal and an illegal map.
There are Oh yeah, that's much more compact now. You can see the part that goes up to Lake Erie is completely taken away.
In John Kimmel's 8th grade math class, groups of students huddle around computers, evaluating Pennsylvania's new congressional district map against the 2011 map the state Supreme Court ruled unconstitutional earlier this year.
No, Butler. It breaks up Butler.
It does. Oh, yeah.
It breaks up one, though. That's
only
still a lot less than
And Cambridge.
James Bradley, one of the students at Westtown, a private Quaker school, also finds the new map splits fewer counties than the previous map.
I think it follows county lines much better. The number of counties that have been broken up in the 2011 map versus the 2018 map, it's much fewer this time around, and I think it's definitely going to represent the population better and make it a more fair map in the upcoming midterm election.
It would be hard to argue with the students' analysis of the two maps. By several measures, the court-drawn map is more compact, it's contiguous, and keeps more counties whole, all criteria outlined in the court's opinion. The court found the old map deprived voters of their right to free and equal elections and was designed to give Republicans an unfair advantage while diluting Democrats' votes. But now that the court released its own map, a complete overhaul of Pennsylvania's congressional districts, it's still unclear exactly when a map with partisan leanings could be considered unconstitutional.
If you have a design that's flawed from the get-go, it's difficult to know exactly how much of it to scrap in order to get to the constitutional bit that's left.
Justin Levitt is a law professor who specializes in voting rights and redistricting at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. He compares the redistricting battle in Pennsylvania to a traffic stop, where state GOP leaders who designed the map have been caught speeding.
The legislature was clock going 120. It blew through all of the speed limits. So the court didn't have to decide whether the speed limit was 50 or 55 or 60 or 40. The court said, you were going 120. We don't have to decide exactly what the speed limit is. You were speeding.
During the next redistricting process, after the 2020 census, Levitt says lawmakers will at least know they have to stay under 120. But as far as how fast, or rather how partisan, their maps can favor one party over another, that remains unsettled.
The second case I have to announce, Veith versus Jubilee.
The U.S. Supreme Court has long held that politics and partisan considerations is inherent in the redistricting process. Here's the late Justice Antonin Scalia in 2004.
The basic problem is that some degree of political motivation and effect in districting is not unconstitutional. No one contends that a decent amount of political motivation and political effect is unlawful. So it comes down to determining how much political motivation and effect is too much.
In its majority opinion, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court found that political considerations must come second to a map being compact and contiguous, but did not outline exactly where that line can be blurred. And that vagueness doesn't sit well with Amanda Holt. If ever there were a redistricting celebrity in Pennsylvania, it would be Amanda Holt.
No free lunches. I certainly don't feel like a celebrity by any means. I think that my story shows just how an ordinary citizen can engage in issues they care about and have a huge impact.
Holt's a piano teacher in Allentown and a Republican Lehigh County commissioner. Back in 2012, she challenged the constitutionality of the district lines used for state races and won. In this recent ruling, the court's opinion borrowed from the criteria used for state races, but Holt says the court didn't really live up to this standard.
One of the most important rules in there is that you aren't allowed to split any place unless you need to make for equal population.
Compared to any other map that was proposed recently, the court-drawn version divides the least amount of counties, but it splits more municipalities than other options, including a submission from state GOP leaders.
It's puzzling to me because I wonder why they chose to ignore their own court order. You would expect the judiciary would be really good about following the rules, particularly that they lay out. So it makes you question whether they really were invested in following this rule or whether they had some other motivations that were prompting them to create the map that they did.
So why did the court choose its map over the others? Would the other plans have passed constitutional muster? Keystone Crossroads reached out to the court-appointed advisor to inquire about other possible motivations not mentioned in court orders or opinions, but he said he was not allowed to comment. Political analysts point out that the new map is more favorable to Democrats. And they hypothesize that the court went out of its way to make the map fairer, according to voter registration data. There's more Democrats in Pennsylvania than Republicans, but the old map clearly advantaged the GOP. The new version seems like it will make things more equal in the delegation sent to Washington. But this idea of fairness is nowhere overtly in state or federal law. For Holt, the uncertainty here illustrates the need for much clearer standards.
I think the ideal process really comes down to not so much about who's drawing the maps, but making sure you have clear and measurable rules so that you can hold those drawing the maps accountable, because you can see that no matter who draws the map, whether it's the courts, whether it's the legislature, there are questions that arise.
She hopes those rules will be in place for the next round of redistricting, just around the corner. Lindsay Lazarski, Keystone Crossroads.
He is going deep, and is it a touchdown? I'm awaiting the signal.
It is.
It is! Touchdown! Touchdown to Clement.
Well, I never drew it up, but it worked.
What a great throw by Nick Foles. He's done it time and time again.
Less than 1 month after the Eagles' triumphant Super Bowl parade, NFL Films' 2017 Philadelphia Eagles Super Bowl Champions Super Bowl 52 Instant Highlight will be released tomorrow. Joining me is David Plout, longtime senior producer at NFL Films. Dave, thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Glad to be here with you, Dave. This is Dave Radio.
And indeed, let's note that more accurately, you are a former senior producer having just retired. When did you start with NFL Films?
I began on August 2nd, 1976, the same week that Legionnaires' disease hit the Bellevue Stratford Hotel. So I hope that was not a harbinger of my career. I was here the year of the bicentennial, and so that's 42 seasons at NFL Films.
So we won't get too much in the weeds, but how has this turned around in a matter of weeks? There were some 40 producers and 40 people on the staff accumulating sound and video. How did you get to this final product so quickly?
So what you have to do is you have to start preparing about 4 weeks out when the playoffs are underway. After the wild card rounds are done, you see who the eight teams are that are still left in each conference. And then a crew of producers is assigned, one to the NFC, one to the AFC. And you begin collating the material on the teams that you think are likely to advance. And then when you're down to just two teams in each conference, you start pulling all those elements into a project in a digitally based editing system. And you have them all ready to go. And then the next day, after we know who's going to the Super Bowl in each conference, you start making a film about it. So the Friday before the Super Bowl is even played, the entire rest of the film is already done. And you're just waiting for the Super Bowl to be played. And then once that's done, it's a real two-minute drill to get that game edited and produced and finished. And then the whole film is done by the following Friday after the Super Bowl, 5 days after the game is played. The film is done, and it goes out to the duplicator so that they can start churning out DVDs and Blu-rays.
Certainly more so than baseball and especially basketball. Football players are enshrouded in padding and helmets, and part of the magic of this film is the viewer is right there on the field, focusing on eye contact, emotions, and also talk between players, talk from players to coaches, including, iconically, the quarterback's appeal to the coach to put in the Philly special play.
We had wired three Eagles people. One was Coach Peterson, one was Nick Foles, and one was Malcolm Jenkins, and we sometimes you guess wrong, and you get a guy who doesn't play very well, doesn't have much of an impact on the game. In this case, we hit the trifecta. All three were very instrumental in the Eagles' win, so their sound is heard throughout that game. And we also wired many players throughout the season. So in this film, which is the entire year from opening day right through the Super Bowl, you're going to get sound quality of a similar nature. You're going to hear a lot of stuff that you would never be able to hear watching TV and certainly not attending the games.
Just sheer coincidence that you're going out the ultimate winner?
I wasn't anticipating this. I had just finished a film on the Ice Bowl, which ran on NFL Network in late December to celebrate the 50th anniversary of that game. There was a league buyout that was offered to us, and so a lot of us were leaving. So many of us didn't know how that last month was going to go. And then when they told me I was working on this film, I said to myself, hey, I wonder if maybe this one time I can finally get an Eagles championship. Naturally, like many other people, I was somewhat skeptical because of the Carson Wentz injury, but I was very happy to have those fears dashed and to have it end up the way it did.
Somewhat skeptical, or like me, if I were to confess, no way they were going to win without Wentz.
When they found a way to beat Atlanta, I thought, okay, maybe they've got a chance. And then Nick Foles played the game of his life, at least for 1 or 2 weeks, and then he outdid himself 2 weeks later in Minneapolis. So it was great. It all turned out great. The whole season was so much fun. It was a fun team to watch. They were imaginative. They were daring. They were even funny when they weren't playing football with many of their choreographed dances, which you will see most of them in full flower in the film. It just was a great season. It just was a lot of fun. Even if you were not particularly partisan towards the Eagles, you would say to yourself, God, this is a really exciting team to watch on both sides of the ball.
Well, what a wonderful swan song, the Eagles season and the NFL film release. Thank you for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thank you, Dave. It was a pleasure.
David Plout, former senior producer at NFL Films.
Was Clement inbounds when he made the play?
Let's go to that angle, Al, and let me look at that first foot. Now, you know what's going to mean this back on the left there? That's all control. That's all control, man.
March came in like a lion, but by this Sunday, there will be a sure sign of spring to come. Joining me to establish the timeline is Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, where are we going and when?
Forward into the future, but just an hour. Sunday morning at 2 a.m., we go from standard time to daylight saving time. And that will be opening the door for us to head forward into spring because, of course, if you've been paying attention early in the morning, sunrises have been coming earlier and earlier now. So throwing the clock forward also gives us some extra time there in the evenings. So the vernal equinox is just a few days later, another week later, and we'll be rolling right downhill towards summer.
Say, Derek, we wouldn't have had to wait until Sunday for a spring reminder had you brought back a piece of Pasadena weather with you where you were last week.
Oh, it was delightful in Pasadena last week. I was working on a project with BBC and PBS creating a new documentary that will have some content in it about telescopes. And we were in Pasadena to visit two very interesting and historic places. One is the Mount Wilson Observatory just above Los Angeles at an altitude of about 5,700 feet, which in the early 1900s was used by Edwin Hubble to photograph these objects in the sky that were known then as island nebulae, thought to be part of the universe, which at that time was defined as our galaxy alone. He came to realize that they weren't clouds of gas and dust, but instead were galaxies, individual galaxies, spirals like our own. And with this determination, he figured out that, along with some suggestions from Einstein, that the universe is expanding. And I could feel the history in the room. There are thousands of plates here taken by different astronomers that worked at the observatory, but Hubble certainly stand out as some of the most important ones.
We're still trying to determine the ultimate size of the universe, but now the thinking is it's expanding at a faster rate than previously thought.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point because all the galaxies that he observed through spectroscopic analysis seem to be rushing away from the Milky Way galaxy. So he surmised that all the galaxies were rushing away from each other. And he could measure this and found out that the most distant ones were moving away faster than closer ones, but that there was a rate at which it seemed that this was happening. And what Hubble's work pointed to is that it was not the galaxies that were rushing away from each other, but that the entire universe is expanding and thus pulling the galaxies along with them. So the Hubble constant, as this number is known, has very great consequence for us understanding the true origin of the universe.
There is we think, a fixed amount of matter, whether we call it the stuff that we can see or dark matter or energy, But if it's increasingly occupying a larger and larger universe, could it eventually dilute out that there's virtually nothing left?
At some point, that is going to be the case. While Hubble expected that the expansion of the universe would get to a certain point and stop and then collapse again, the researchers in 1998 actually won a Nobel Prize for their discovery that the universe's expansion is accelerating. And it is in that acceleration that we find perhaps the biggest trick of all, which is that if we all hang around long enough, we're going to end up in a very dark and cold place because all of the energy will run down without the opportunity to sort of recoil and restart things again.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller. NewsWorks Tonight.